So this morning, John's Gospel. Dilly mentioned that there's been quite a bit of talk in John's Gospel over these last few weeks about this idea of feet. I mean, there was that thing before about Mary washing Jesus' feet and then putting the perfume all over them and then drying them off with her hair. That was quite an extravagant thing about love, wasn't it? And this morning's topic is all about that as well, about feet. So do you think John has got some sort of thing all about feet that he wants us to know about? Are they somehow majorly important in the spread of the Gospels? Well, actually, these three chapters are the only places where John mentions feet, so we don't have to worry too much about that. But what is the point of John's Gospel? Do you remember from Terry's talk a few weeks ago? He was saying about how John is actually quite clear, and he says at the end of John's Gospel what it's about, but pretty much in every single chapter of John's Gospel, he speaks about what the purpose is of which, about which he's writing. And in this chapter, in verses 19 to 20, just beyond what we read, it says, "I'm telling you now, before it happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe who I am. Very truly, I tell you, whoever accepts anyone I send accepts me, and whoever accepts me accepts the one who sent me." Jesus wants you to believe that he, or rather John, wants you to believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and then to accept that message of life which he brings. So today's story. You picture the scene. You've got Peter and you've got John. And they've been sent to prepare the room for the Passover feast. The Passover feast is the annual celebration in which the Israelites relive the whole story of the Passover when Moses led the people of Israel out of Egypt and into the Promised Land. For them, it was like a kind of Christmas celebration, a huge celebration, greatly enjoyable. A lot of work to prepare for it, but a lot of good food as well. It was really good fun and something that was obligatory for all Israelites. But this time, something wasn't quite right. Well, at least it wasn't right in Peter's eyes, because the seating arrangements were probably not quite what he'd wanted. You see, John, who was probably Jesus' closest friend, was sitting at Jesus' right hand. But on the left, it wasn't Peter or James who kind of wanted to be there, but it was Judas. Judas was sitting next to Jesus, which kind of might have made Peter a little bit upset. And we read in one of the other Gospels that the disciples were arguing throughout the meal as to who would be the greatest. And seating arrangements were kind of a big thing, and so Peter being put a bit away from Jesus was kind of like the father of the bride at a wedding being put as far away as possible from the top table. It just didn't feel good. And this meal, well, it was the first part of Jesus' kind of lastminute.com bucket list, the thing that he wanted to do before he died. Do you have a bucket list? You know, the kind of list of things you want to do before you kick the bucket, before you die? Well, I tried to search on Google to find some interesting things to share with you about a good bucket list idea, what you might want. The first page I came up with a message just saying, fatal error. I thought it was kind of ironic, really, wasn't it? But most of the suggestions seem to suggest that you do either something daring, like learning how to milk a cow while skateboarding through an alligator-infested swamp in a tornado, or travel somewhere exotic and romantic like Slough, or just tell everyone in the world how much you love them and what wonderful people they are. But over these next few weeks, as we go through the end of John's Gospel, we're going to look at Jesus' final bucket list. Now, Jesus was perfect. As we see in verse 1 and various other times in the Gospel, he knew that his hour had come. Jesus knew now was the time. His time was coming. And these next seven chapters, we'll see Jesus fulfill all the remaining things on his bucket list. He He was perfect. He did all the things that he wanted to do, and all these things were important. The things he said and the things he did over these next 7 chapters. And they cover the last 24 hours of his life before his death on the cross. And the things on Jesus' list were very different from anything that I would have had on my list what to do in the last 24 hours of my life. So, since the disciples had been thinking about who would be the greatest, no one had really had it on their mind as to who was going to wash everyone's feet. And as Gillian has shown us and talked about really quite well this morning, we've seen that it wasn't really the most pleasant job. It should have been for a servant. And you know, Peter might have been thinking, well, I'm one of Jesus' inner circle, closest to friends, so I shouldn't wash the feet. And maybe Judas was thinking, well, I've been promoted in this meal now to the most prestigious place, just to the side of the rabbi, so clearly I'm important, then I don't need to wash this rabble's feet, do I? And Thomas may have just been doubting as to whether anyone would do it. We don't really know what they're thinking, but, well, anyone could have done it, and somebody should have got up and done it. Nobody actually did do it. And so no one had their feet washed. And that probably made the room a little bit stinky. So then the ceremony began. And as rabbi, Jesus would lead it. And when it came to the ritual washing of hands, he picked up the water pitcher and the towel, and he did the unthinkable. He didn't just wash their hands, but he knelt down and he washed their feet as well. The master was doing the job of the slave. Well, it made them feel a little bit uncomfortable. We don't read about 11 of the 12 of them complaining about it. They didn't object. After all, you know, they knew they needed their feet washing. They knew there was a bit of a smell and someone had to do it. And, well, it kind of solved the problem, didn't it? But what was going on in Jesus' mind while he was doing this? Just think about it. Maybe as he knelt before Bartholomew, he might have remembered all the things that he'd taught his disciples over these last 3 or 4 years. And how this bunch of ungrateful so-and-sos didn't seem to have taken it on board at all. But he didn't think of them in that way. He loved them. And so he knelt down and he washed Bartholomew's feet. And maybe he came to Thaddeus. And he might have thought how what was just coming up in a few hours' time, that he was going to be arrested and beaten almost to death. And that thought might have caused him to shudder. But despite all those concerns about what was happening soon, he stooped down to wash Thaddeus' feet. And he came to Philip. And maybe then the thoughts of how the Jewish people would treat him, how they were turning against him, how they're going to condemn him to death, despite all the good things he'd done for them, might have gone through his mind. But still, he loved them. And he continued on and washed Philip's feet. And in Matthew, well, maybe it was Matthew, maybe he was thinking about the excruciating death which he was going to have there on the cross, abandonment by God and by man. And he carried on and he washed Matthew's feet. And as he washed Simon's feet, he might have thought about he'd be taken down from the cross by the secret followers, wrapped in linen and buried in a tomb. But he continued on and washed Simon's feet. We don't know which order he washed their feet in, but we do know at one stage he came to Judas. Judas. Judas, who would later betray him. And from John 6, chapter 6, verse 64, we know that Jesus had known from the beginning that Judas would betray him. And here, Jesus was not face to face, but face to feet with a thief and a traitor, a spy in their midst. And he knew that Judas had already agreed his betrayal. He may have even known the price which Judas had received for it, a paltry 30 pieces of silver. Was that all that the life of the Son of Man, the Son of God, was worth? But as Jesus looked at Judas, he loved him. He had always loved him, and he would love him right to the end. And so he knelt before his betrayer, and he washed Judas's feet. And he came to John, and he knew that John would be the most loyal of all. But, well, that's not really much of a claim to fame when all of them would run away. And so in love, he knelt down. And as he washed, he might have thought about how John would join the others in fleeing and keeping a safe distance from the action. Yet still, he washed his feet. And then Thomas, well, he knew Thomas, like the others, just didn't really get it. And that even when he rose again from death, that Thomas would still doubt whether he was really alive. But he still showed his love by kneeling down and washing Thomas's feet. And so it went on until he came to Peter. Now, Peter had had some time to think by now about what was going on, and in a bit of a holier-than-thou attitude, Peter said, "Are you going to wash my feet, Lord?" As if somehow having let Jesus do all the hard work for the other 11 was okay, but he was going to show the others just how great and wonderful and magnanimous he was by washing his own feet. But Peter didn't really understand what Jesus was doing. So Jesus explained the symbolism in his action. As they've known him and as they've loved him, they've been made clean. Yet even though their hearts have been changed, yet still they get things wrong. They still sin. They still have bad attitudes from time to time. And they need cleansing. But they don't need to start from scratch and wash their whole bodies all over again. They just need a quick rinse. The washing of hands and feet. The confession of their sins. Although Peter had no idea of what was going on, Jesus went ahead and washed his feet, knowing that in less than 12 hours' time, Peter, one of his closest friends, was going to deny him three times. Peter, the fearless one, was going to let him down. Peter, the rock, was going to disown his Lord. And as Jesus returns to his place, he explains that just as he has done for them, he wants them also to do for others. Now that's just kind of like the first part of Jesus' unusual bucket list. He didn't just tell the disciples about his love for them, but he showed them physically in a way that they would remember for years to come. And over the next few weeks, we'll see more and more of this theme of the importance of love for one another as one of Jesus' priorities for his disciples to know before he left them. And in verses 34 to 35 of the chapter, it explains why. "I'm giving you a new commandment that you should love one another. As I have loved you, so you also should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you have love one for another." Now, at this point, the brighter of the disciples may have thought, "I got it. I know what Jesus meant." They may have figured out that the distinguishing mark of Jesus' followers, for you and me today, was not just foot washing, but it was serving one another. That's it. We need to serve one another, do these stuff to help each other out. Jesus had loved them and showed his love by becoming humble and serving them, so they should serve others. And that's good. But serving one another, that's like just the starting point for the standard of love that Jesus is talking about. And maybe later when they saw Judas betray Jesus in the garden, they may have been able to put two and two together and realize, when Jesus talked about loving your enemy in the Sermon on the Mount, he was talking about something that was going to be a real painful reality for him, that he was going to show his love and wash the feet of his enemy, Judas the betrayer. Wow. What an incredible love Jesus had. That even though he knew Judas would betray him, he still washed his feet and spoke graciously to him throughout the meal. And that is the kind of love that Jesus expects us to have for one another and for our enemies today. But to grasp fully what Jesus meant by loving one another, we need to flick forward a couple of chapters to John 15, 12 and 13, where it says, "My command is this, love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. Laying down one's life for one's friends. That's a bit of a higher standard of love. And Jesus was not talking metaphorically here. Because about 12 hours after he said this, he'll be nailed to a cross and lay down his life, not just for his friends, but for his enemies too. And as he washed his enemies' feet, he was now going to die so that his enemies might have the chance to live. And Romans chapter 5, verse 10 tells us that it is while we were still his enemies that he died to reconcile us to himself. Jesus died not just for the good and for the righteous, but for his enemies, for those who crucified him, for you and for me. Jesus loved his enemies to the point of death. And his command to love one another still stands today. Jesus is still expecting you and me to love one another as he loved us. And you'd be glad to know that Jesus wasn't specifically saying that we should wash one another's feet. That was just one example of how we might put it into practice. And like he told the teacher of the law, as he explained the commandment about loving your neighbour as yourself, in the parable of the Good Samaritan, love was not to be just a feeling, but something that was practically outworked, an action, meeting people at their point of need. Love wasn't just some wishy-washy, easy option, but it was the power through which Jesus was going to transform the world. The power through which today Jesus is transforming the world. Because love was what took Jesus to the cross. And he calls on each one of us to take up our cross and to follow him. He calls each one of us here this morning to show our love for him by loving one another. Not just with words, not just to the point of inconvenience, not just to where it hurts or stretches us to the limit, but as far as possible, to death. Love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he laid down his life for his friends. But he's not calling us to do this in our own power or strength, because humanly speaking, that's impossible. But as he fills us with his love, as we understand more and more the incredible, the extravagant and overflowing love of Jesus for us, then we will be enabled to love one another with a supernatural love, with a love that washes feet, or washes clothes, or cleans houses, with a love that goes out of its way to find out the needs of others and to meet those needs. Now, as an example of this, there was this Cypriot guy called Joe. You might have heard of him. He took Jesus' call to love the followers of Jesus so strongly, so seriously, that he sold his property and gave the money to the church so that they could meet the needs of the poor. That's pretty serious. But in case you think it was just in monetary terms that, you know, he's a rich guy so he could afford to do it, he then went on to be the first person in his congregation to welcome an extremist into their midst when everyone else had been scared of him. He then went on to encourage a new church that had formed. And, needing help to do this, he encouraged this former extremist to come and help him to teach them. And he showed love, so much love to those around him, that after a while, he received a new nickname from his church, which was Son of Encouragement. You may know him better as the name we say in English, Barnabas. Barnabas, the encourager. He was an incredible model of love. And you might wonder, what would have happened to the church or to the Apostle Paul if it wasn't for Barnabas's love and support? You don't know the end result of the love that you show or don't show. Now, our church's vision is to be a place of love and welcome. And that's why we've chosen the theme of welcome for this year. Got the verse up on the walls there about how we should welcome one another as Christ welcomed you for the glory of God. We think it's so important that we're running a course all about welcoming that Elsie was speaking about the notices this morning, because it's not just something for the gifted few. It's something for all of us, something that we all can do as we are filled with Jesus' love for us. We want to be a welcoming community where people from all nations and backgrounds want to come. We want to encourage one another to show love to those who are different from ourselves and help them become a part of the life of this church here. We want to be full of this love of Jesus. But it will only come about as we appreciate the love of Jesus more for ourselves, as we are filled with his love, as we look at his love and take it seriously and think about it. But what part are you going to play? Are you willing to love? A new command I give you. Love one another as I have loved you. So you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. I'll ask the worship group to come up now because we're going to come to communion soon. And as we do come to the communion table, let's take a moment to stop and think about that incredible love that Jesus has for you. Pause and consider that love that brought the creator of the universe down to his knees to wash his enemies' feet. And meditate on the fact that while you were still a sinner, Christ died for you. Let's just bow our head in the time of quiet now and think about Jesus there in the upper room, washing his disciples' feet and ready to wash your feet. And as you do, confess your sin to him, the ways you failed him this week, how you've been unloving, and how you need him to wash you clean.